Okay, so here's the deal. My plan this morning was to talk about Christopher Columbus, his mission, his agenda, the motives of his financiers, and some of the less glamorous bits of his life. I will touch on those seedy bits later, but for now, there is a more pressing matter at hand. On Friday, late Friday, the Washington Post released a video recording of the presidential nominee of one of the two major parties saying utterly, utterly lewd and disgusting things about women. The candidate described committing sexual assault, of forcing his physical attentions on women, and claiming that because he was famous, they let him do what he wanted. He used vulgar terms for women's bodies and described how he would put his hands on them without their consent. He also talked about trying to seduce a married woman who eventually turned him down and implied that she was the outlier in his experience. Now, predictably, the internet exploded and the candidate's party imploded. Former presidential candidates and former presidents across the political spectrum have denounced his words. Pundits and politicians have called for the candidate to abandon his run for the White House. By Saturday evening, the National Party had yanked all funding for operations promoting the top of the ticket. Stranding this alleged billionaire to either raise private money or use his own checkbook for the next 31 days of the campaign. If history is any indicator of the future, it's going to be an ugly, if entertaining, 31 days. For a short while on Saturday, the name of the vice presidential running mate disappeared from the official campaign website. Rumors swirled and constitutional scholars became sudden celebrities as they explained to various news outlets the details and intricacies of the American electoral process. The long and short of it boils down to this: unless a candidate dies or is rendered incapable through illness or accident to voluntarily withdraw from the race, the party cannot remove him from the ticket. There is no mechanism for buyer's remorse. The term caveat emptor has taken on grave significance. So it appears that the candidate for president has trouble with personal restraint and boundaries. I am sure many people are surprised. I do not understand that surprise, but I am sure there are some for whom this was a revelation. As I typed this sermon last night, more and more recordings were surfacing. Outtakes from reality television programs, audio tapes from when the candidate was mic'd up and the cameras were rolling. For technicians, it's just easier to let things record than it is to stop and start and stop and start all the time. So everything said on the set made it to tape or digital audio now. More evidence will undoubtedly emerge in the coming days and weeks, and perhaps even years. That is the way when a dam of secrecy cracks. First one, then another. Then a flood of truth pours forth in volumes that cannot be denied. Now, this is very different from ganging up and piling onto a victim. In this kind of instance, it is the powerless who begin to find their voices, and supported by one another, even in the face of new and terrible treatment, they show up and tell the truth, name what has been done, and call for accountability. The candidate, of course, is reeling. He is embarrassed and upset, feeling attacked for behaving in a way that has been acceptable in the circles in which he operates. And make no mistake about it, in the circles where this candidate grew up, power, wealth, masculinity, and the privilege they provide permit behavior that can make polite society wince and look away. There was a time not so long ago when men were broadly understood to be entitled access, sexual access, to women's bodies for their own entertainment and pleasure. Less than 50 years ago, spousal rape was not even a thing addressed in the legal code. 100 years ago, white men could use women of color in any degrading and dehumanizing way they wanted, largely free of recompense. 150 years ago, just across the river, if a white man wanted to kill their enslaved person as punishment for some offense, real or conjured, they could do so without fear of punishment. Women and people of color were property, things to be owned and maintained in whatever way the master felt appropriate. Now, this culture did not spring fresh from the earth when our nation was founded. It did not arrive fully formed at the beginning of the Civil War, nor did it emerge as the trade in enslaved African people grew in the American South. The culture of treating some people different than others came to America by an Italian guy underwritten by the Spanish crown who was desperately off course for his intended destination. And this is the weekend when the United States celebrates the efforts of Christopher Columbus, the last of a series of explorers to discover the North American continent, but the first to have the backing of both church and crown and their accompanying publicity machines. Columbus was sent west, across the ocean, for all the reasons explorers went anywhere in those days: to find riches and wealth and resources to exploit, to claim new lands for whatever government had hired him, and to navigate a shorter route to India and the traders located there. As a subtext of this agenda was a command and blessing by the church. At that time, there was only one, the Holy Catholic Church, steeped in the military conquest and expansionism culture of the Holy Roman Empire. The second order of the day was to civilize and convert to Christianity whatever kind of savage peoples they might encounter. And to that end, priests accompanied soldiers among the ship's companions. Any culture's foundational story plays a significant role in how that culture behaves and conducts itself. Let me tell you a story. When I was in seminary, I heard a woman speak who was, she was the head of the chaplaincy program at Mass General Hospital, big shot hospital in Boston. And she told the story of origin of that hospital, and it was founded back in the day on an island in sort of a murky, swampy part of Boston. And the intent of that decision was to restrict access. If you could not afford to pay the boatman, you could not afford the services you could find there. It was a way to avoid providing charity care. And she said, that story of origin is in the foundational DNA of Mass General Hospital. And she said, if you don't think it affects how decisions are made to this day by the Board of Trustees, you are sorely mistaken. What happens in the beginning sets the tone for events that follow. Like a cast iron pan, systems carry with them the flavor of their birth story. If you season a new pan, a new cast iron pot, by cooking spicy chorizo sausage in it, okay? The things you cook in that pan for a long time will bear the hint of that spice. And so when Columbus arrived in this hemisphere, he carried with him more than just 90 moderately unhappy sailors and soldiers and priests. He brought a culture of imperialism and colonialism, of European and Christian exceptionalism and assumed superiority. People who were not Christians or European ancestry were simply considered to be less than human, animals even, and available like merchant goods for the consumption of men. When he arrived on Hispaniola, Columbus first made friends with the natives, then captured and enslaved them, bringing some back to Spain as gifts for Ferdinand and Isabella, his sponsors. In return for these gifts and his efforts to secure them property, the monarchs offered Columbus governorship of the island and its surrounding lands and a fancy title as Admiral of the Ocean Sea. Turns out he was really a bad governor of land and people and shortly faced mutinies and rebellions. He developed a penchant for killing and enslaving the island natives, and was eventually shipped back to Spain to face charges in chains. Columbus came to this hemisphere with the idea of consuming what he found here, and that's what he did. Acquisition and exploitation was the charge he was given by his sponsors. That was his job. He brought back fruits and vegetables, musical instruments of the island people, their jewelry and their art, and as much of their culture as he thought could be sold in the royal courts of Spain. It is perhaps only slightly ironic that of all the things Columbus brought back with him from the Americas, it was probably the previously unknown strain of syphilis that decimated his crew and then great swaths of Europe around the turn of the 16th century. Eventually, it settled down into more of a chronic ailment that killed people slowly, but those first years were unpleasant. It is perhaps the only real punishment Spain ever experienced for its colonization of the New World. Now, my original thought when considering Columbus Day was to examine the ways in which Europeans have historically raided foreign cultures for their riches and art while doing profound violence to people of those cultures. This is a topic that often comes up in October when some celebrate Columbus Day and others Indigenous Peoples Day. And American children clamor for whatever is popular Halloween costume of the year. I remember as a child and as an unaware young adult dressing up for parties as a wide variety of culturally inappropriate things, ranging from a Native American person or a gypsy or some other marginalized group. I did not understand then how offensive those images and that behavior are to members of those groups. Today, I am more aware and I look back on those younger years and cringe at what I had done. I struggle with the urge to go find every person of color I know and apologize for my being an unthinking git when I was 17. White guilt is not particularly helpful to the work of justice, and it is not my friend's responsibility to make me feel better after I've behaved badly. That's my work. The best apology I can offer is to change my behavior and become a solid ally. And so we come to this European-based culture that treats the world like its own sort of grand flea market of cool things, where trinkets can be collected and riches exploited without regard for the people whose lives are involved. That's a broad brush, I get that. Not all people, I get it. And we look around us in 2016 And we see a 70-year-old rich white guy who views the world around him as his own personal buffet of pleasures to be consumed without regard for the human lives involved. Columbus didn't discover America. The Vikings were here first, and some other folks, and even another Italian explorer named Vespucci made the trip long before Columbus did. And he didn't prove the world was round. Galileo had started that rumor years before, and by the time the late 1400s rolled around, everybody sort of figured it was true. People didn't have a clear idea how big the planet was, so they thought it would take much less time to get around it. But still, Columbus didn't prove anything new. He didn't discover anything that hadn't already been reported. What happened was, he got good publicity. He was friends with the people who wrote textbooks. He became popular, really, after the American Revolutionary War. He was lost to history before then. But what happened is, after the Revolutionary War, America, these new Americans, these patriots, looked around and they're like, we need to compile our history and understand how we got where we are. And British explorers were kind of out of fashion at that time. And so they looked around and they're like, here's this guy that's got sort of a vague, fuzzy history. Nobody knows a whole lot about him. And they built this narrative around him. So America had a hero. It didn't matter that his biography was pure fiction, that his finances were a mess, and that he had failed at managing the riches his sponsor had given to him. He was a good story, as long as you didn't look too closely, and that worked for America. Good thing we're past all that, huh? Is this mic on? October is the month in which we explore integrity, what it means to us, how we embody it, how we live it in our lives. So far, it's been a really rough month for integrity in America. How do we embody integrity in a world that seems so devoted to be just the opposite? We do it the way we do anything. We do it one bite at a time, bit by bit, piece by piece, bird by bird, as Anne Lamott tells us. Each day we get up and do what we can to speak the truth, even when it scares us. Each day we get up and work to be more aware of our own privileges in this world. Each day we get up and commit to listen more than we talk, to serve more than we demand, to give more than we receive. Integrity is not about being truthful on your resume. It's more than that. Integrity is what we do when we think nobody is watching. Integrity is how we behave when we are alone and there are no witnesses. Integrity is about how integrated our values are with how we behave in our everyday lives. And integrity is a spiritual practice. To be honest and fair, to be kind and generous, to be true to our word, to keep our promises, to keep confidences that are shared with us, speak up when we see injustice happening. All of these things are spiritual practices that we can engage in that make the world a better place. They cannot be done by any other means than one voice at a time, speaking up, raising up the truth, shining a light into the dark corners and bringing us all back to a place of wholeness and integrity. This is my prayer. May it be so.